This is a program about murder. Architectural murder. You are going to witness the severed limbs, the pulped torso of a great city. No doubt to many of you the word murder will seem exaggerated. You will say that what we call today development is a necessary part of change. If you really think this, so much the worse for you, and so much the worse for your children. They ask for bread, in this particular you give them not stone, but dead concrete. A building like this. Lifeless, faceless, hopeless, joyless, mean-spirited. Damning the sky with its load of untrying. Ruining everything around it.
Well, is London really falling down? Peter Schaffer seemed to think so way back in 1969, when he complained so vociferously about the murder of our cities. Since then, the modern architect has hardly ever been out of the news. Controversy has followed controversy, and modern architecture clearly finds itself at the crossroads. That's the subject of this special edition of Meridian, and it's also the title of a major new series currently running on British television, which asks what really went wrong with the post-war dream.
The lethal combination of planners, architects, and the idea of progress, the idea that somewhere we can invent a form of building which would be able to solve all human problems, was absolutely fatal. And we lived a time where people thought quite altruistically that they could build for people instead of building with them. The original ideas of the modern movement were glorious, were marvelous. But I think that the complexity again of modern life watered down the original intention until they were totally drained of any of the really optimistic ideas which the 20s and the 30s had. I mean, we are surrounded by buildings which deny any humanity, and our environment has become absolutely barbaric. We know that. But I don't think one should be too pessimistic. Modern architecture can still be life-enhancing and exciting and absolutely wonderful in the hand of the right people.
Peter Adam, who wrote and directed Architecture at the Crossroads, which is the most ambitious and controversial examination of modern architecture ever mounted on British television. In the series, Adam travels the world in search of good modern buildings. He visits Cairo and Kuwait, Berlin and Tokyo, constantly asking the same question. What have we done to our cities since the war? Have we adorned them with splendid new architecture, or have we indeed murdered them? For our own vantage point, we chose one of London's most famous and tallest landmarks, St. Paul's Cathedral, designed by Sir Christopher Wren. Since it was completed in 1710, the Dome of St. Paul's, 300 feet above the city, has provided a constantly changing panorama of London. And on a bitterly cold February morning, as the wind howled around us and the Thames snaked away at our feet, with Big Ben just visible on the horizon, I climbed the Dome of St. Paul's in the company of Sir Hugh Casson, former president of the Royal Academy and himself a leading architect. The London we saw sprawling into the distance beneath us was not a pretty sight.
I'm afraid it's not unexpectedly a muddle. It's a muddle in its plan. It's a muddle in the relationship of one building to another, and it's a muddle in particular when you're looking down on the roofs in the way that the architects have allowed the finish of their buildings to be left to chance ducts, engineering, smokestacks, and little wooden sheds with people making tea in them. God knows what they're all up to.
By and large, what kind of building do you think we've seen in London since the war, and how good has it been?
I'm afraid one has to admit that there have been a lot of opportunities missed. This is partly a question of speed, trying to get buildings up quickly, which were badly needed, partly a question of conservatism in that people who own building sites wanted to go back after the bombing to exactly where they were before, with exactly the same sort of house. And there was a great boom in the late 50s and early 60s. When most of the office blocks that you see around you here were built, and they were built too quickly by people who are really after the cash. It was three-dimensional real estate, not architecture, I'm afraid, and there's a great deal of that. And in every city in the world, they had the same problem.
Now, I remember when I was a student seeing a famous painting of this part of London by Canaletto, which bristled with beautiful church spires, which made London look extremely elegant and extremely pleasant place to live. Now, it really has changed an awful lot.
Well, Christopher Wren, of course, on whose balcony we're actually standing at the moment, he believed that you should keep a reasonably level roof level right the way through the middle of the city. The only things to come up would be the spires, and he built about 50 of them. Plain walls, he said, and keep all your celebration to the spires, many of which, thank goodness, remain, although buried among the office blocks which have followed them. I think he was right. You see, Paris has managed to keep a level roof line right the way through the centre of Paris. Venice, of course, has done so. I believe Stockholm kept a pretty strong level for many years. But we, like often in England, do half and half. We keep it low in certain places and high in other places. And in the end, it's not a tremendous success.
Your answer there makes me think that what we are really lacking in London, and indeed in Britain, is a kind of architectural planning, a foresight that takes into account not just one building or two, but a whole area.
What you're saying, in fact, is, of course, what we need is somebody with a very dictatorial attitude. What we did, of course, after the war and this utopian atmosphere, and we thought things were going to be better than they were, was we did get a plan out for trying to keep St. Paul's as the centrepiece in this part of London and dishing away. So there'd be no high buildings close to it, but they would be allowed to get progressively higher as they got further away. That plus an idea, which was a doomed idea really, that you keep certain famous views. There's a very famous view from the foot of Big Ben, looking downriver towards St. Paul's. But of course, towers behind are almost as obtrusive towers in front. And they make a sort of ring, a semicircular ring at the back of St. Paul's Cathedral. Some of them are exciting and some of them are rather dull, I think. I still like to see a remnant of Christopher Wren's vision, which was this great flagship riding among a lot of little yachts, all the city churches all around it.
One of the things that this solution, that is leaving St. Paul's so visible here, one of the things that seems to me to speak of is a general spirit of conservation that seems to have ridden through English architecture. It seems if we don't want to change the old ways, we do want to leave things as they are.
I think that's true, but I don't think there's much affection for the buildings of the last 30, 40 years. I think if some of them are going to be pulled down, I think there might be cheering in the streets rather than groans.
Well, you could say that again. Shoot an architect and do the world a favour. That's the advice one recent critic gave to the public. And those who think that all modern architects should be rounded up and shot recently received some encouragement from an unexpected quarter. No less a person than His Royal Highness Prince Charles, the Prince of Wales, sparked off an enormous controversy when he entered the fray and attacked one particular example of modern architecture. Addressing the Royal Institute of British Architects in 1984, he gave this opinion of a proposal for one of London's most famous and glamorous sites, Trafalgar Square, where a new extension was being planned for the National Gallery.
Instead of designing an extension to the elegant facade of the National Gallery, which complements it and continues the concept of columns and domes, it looks as if we may be presented with a kind of vast municipal fire station, complete with a sort of tower that contains the sun. I would understand better this type of high-tech approach if you demolished the whole of Trafalgar Square and started again, with a single architect responsible for the entire layout. But what is proposed seems to me like a monstrous carbuncle on the face of a much loved and elegant friend.
Standing beside Prince Charles that day, and as surprised, I imagine, as anyone by the directness of the royal attack, was the then president of the RIBA, Michael Mansour. If with those few spicy words, Prince Charles undoubtedly made himself the darling of the anti-modern architecture lobby, Michael Mansour has fought a determined battle for the other side, taking every opportunity to champion good modern building. But why is it that so much of today's audience finds the word modern synonymous with the word ugly?
That's not a new reaction. It's been the same pretty well through history. And I'll give you a for instance. In the 18th century, there's a very famous architect called Vanbrugh, who's since been highly respected, who designed Blenheim Palace, which was described more or less contemporarily by Horace Walpole as execrable within, without, and almost all around. And somebody else called Arthur Young in 1767 referred to Vanbrugh more generally, Vanbrugh whose buildings are monuments of the vilest taste. Now, you don't even get nowadays comments quite as strong as that about even the modern buildings that aren't liked very much. So there's always a reaction against the very new and the very modern in architecture, and there always has. The other one I like quoting is Jane Austen, who more than once in her books, which are in the middle of the 18th century, which is generally regarded as our prime period of architecture, she refers to people pejoratively as living in plain white modern houses. You'd pay a king's ransom for one of those nowadays.
Well, I must say I wouldn't mind living in one of those plain white Georgian houses which Jane Austen dismissed, but I'm not so sure how I would feel in one of the new towers which Sir Hugh Casson and I saw from our vantage point on top of St. Paul's Cathedral, towers which are just beginning to become a major feature of London's architecture. What is it that Michael Manser finds so exciting about skyscrapers?
Exactly the same emotion that excites me about the mosque at Santa Sofia in Constantinople, or St. Paul's Cathedral, St. Peter's, Rome. It is this tremendous impression of scale and grandeur and engineering. I get exactly the same thrill out of Beauvais, the church in northern France, which in fact was the high point of Gothic, so high that they couldn't finish it. Each time they did a bit more, it fell down, so they left, in fact, just the fag end of the nave, because they couldn't get any further. They had stretched their techniques to the point where they couldn't cope any more, and skyscrapers are stretching our techniques to the point where they can't do much more. That's when you get drama and excitement in architecture.
Well, there's certainly both drama and excitement at the moment in the City, the main financial district of London, where for the past 2 years an extraordinary new piece of architecture has been taking shape. It's the new headquarters for Lloyds, the insurance brokers, and its architect is Richard Rogers, best known for his Pompidou Centre in Paris, and the kind of architect Prince Charles was referring to when he complained of towers looking like vast municipal fire stations. I met Richard Rogers at his new building, covered entirely in shiny steel, which glitters like brand new cutlery, with all its pipes on the outside, bristling with services, cantilevered rooms and lift shafts. This tall newcomer certainly made a change from the sedate banking houses and discreet Christopher Wren churches which surrounded it. As we stood beneath the vast glass dome of the interior, jostled by rushing workmen, I wondered what the reaction to the building had been.
It has been described as a donut with a number of towers around it, either donut being the great atrium, which goes through the 13 floors, then you have the sort of rectangular building around the atrium, and then you have six tall towers which are strongly articulated. At the same time, also around here, there's some wonderfully, rather beautiful, articulated Victorian buildings. So we wanted to find the richness of scale, grain, decoration of the Victorian, using the technology of the 20th century to get the building built on cost, on time, and meeting the microcommunication revolution and all those things.
And, of course, using the materials of the 20th century, because I suppose most people passing by, the first thing that will hit them about your building is that it's made of shiny and very, almost I would say, aggressive steel.
There's no question, we very much enjoy using new materials, or materials of our time, shall we say. Innovation does excite us, and we find by using new materials it gives us also new approaches, and therefore new forms, and so the possibility of a greater play of, let us say, light and shadow, which is what architecture is about. I would say that is a building which is made out of three principal materials on the outside. It is glass, and a very special glass. We've designed our own translucent glass on the outside so it'll sparkle. We've called it a wall of light or sparkle glass, so that the building will not be black at night time or when there's not lights in it. So that's the primary external material. There's also a concrete frame, which is a beautifully poured concrete structure, and then a stainless steel towers or cladding wherever there isn't glass. So there are six tall towers, very sculptural, very expressive, which climb on the outside of the building and which sparkle again because they are stainless steel. We've tried to make it of materials which will weather well and materials which belonged very much to this part of the century.
One of the things that I must say I feel very strongly about the building is that it feels like a very light, a very airy structure. Now, that sensation you get very much from the outside with your sparkling glass and your shiny silver, but it's also continued into the inside.
Yes, on the inside we have this great atrium with light pouring in from both the vaulted roof and also from the south window, as we call it, so that it gives you this feeling of lightness. And of course, when we get all the lights on, the whole place will sparkle. One of our interests as architects, as far as the overall design is concerned, is to develop a language where everything is legible. In other words, when you look at the outside of the building, you see, for instance, The lifts are glass boxes which climb up and down the outside of it. They're not in a dark hole where you never see them. They are both visually add to the decoration, shall we say, of the building, as well as functionally in the sense that you can see the whole city and exactly where you're going as you go up in these glass boxes. This goes for every piece of the building. So you see the mullions which hold the glass or the structure or the air conditioning ducts. All the pieces are used to give a scale, to give a grain, and to give a decoration to the building.
As you can hear, they're still building the new Lloyd's headquarters, but when it's finally opened in May, it's almost certain to provoke yet more conflicting architectural discussion. But while it's almost impossible to miss Richard Rogers's huge, glittering new creation, most of London's new building is, of course, being done far, far away from the glamorous limelight. It's here, among the bread-and-butter architecture of the city, that most of the worst mistakes of recent years have been made. If one had to choose one symbol of the very worst kind of modern architectural crime, it would surely be the crumbling housing estate, its walls covered in graffiti, its windows smashed, its windy courtyards covered in litter, and its residents living in perpetual fear of muggers and thieves. The New London has many such estates, and until recently, one of the very worst of them was the Lee View estate in Hackney. But then the architect John Thompson, who's one of the community architects singled out for praise by Prince Charles, was called in, and he has managed to conjure up a quite remarkable transformation. John Thompson was shocked by what he saw when he first visited Lee View estate.
Well, it was appalling. The morale of the community was extremely low. They had actually been fighting a campaign to get their estate modernised, which in those days meant you got moved off the estate. They were fighting really to get out of this place. They couldn't stand it any longer, and they perceived it really as a prison.
Perhaps not a difficult mistake to make, really, when you're looking at those grey buildings on our left. They are very block-like. They look very daunting to live in. Presumably the first thing that you decided when you were called in was to break up some of that monotony and to make the scale of it more human.
We actually worked from the estate for a year and a half, took over one of the flats. We carried out a social survey in great depth, which was very, very useful before we came to any design decisions. We set up methods of communication with the tenants, notably being here was the most important thing of all, and through working with the tenants and trying to understand what their problems were, we began to understand what the underlying reasons were for the failure of the design of the estate.
What made you decide to work so closely with the tenants? Now, of course, architects have a reputation, perhaps unfairly at times, for imposing buildings on society. Now, you have obviously gone in completely the opposite direction and worked directly with the people here. Now, was that a personal decision, or was it something that you believe in, or how did you reach that decision?
Well, there were two reasons. One was a fairly obvious one, which was that our brief was that we had to keep the tenants on the estate. Clearly, we had to work with the tenants, but at the same time, it's very rare for an architect building public housing to actually know who you're housing, and we saw this as a tremendous opportunity really to find out in depth about the problems of this sort of housing. So we welcomed the opportunity, although in fact we were boycotted when we arrived because we were seen as really representing a discredited profession and as a tool of the local authority.
Now, as you move along to the renovated block, I suppose the thing that really hits me is that there's enormous variety, different windows, different doorways, and above all, I think, there's a rather interesting colour scheme on the windows.
We were determined that in the new block, wherever it was possible to identify where people lived, it was important to try and bring this out. It had to proclaim, this is where I live, this is my home, this is my territory. We put front doors onto the street so that the outside of the estate is now ringed with people's private front gardens, their own front porches, and we have tried to bring out, through the elements that have been added to the blocks, as much colour and variety as possible.
What John Thompson did to humanise this vast brick sprawl was to break up the prison-like effect of the long bare walls with an extremely lively collection of porticos, balconies, front gardens, little pitched roofs and coloured windows, creating an altogether more jumbled and less formal exterior. The building no longer stands at attention, but looks quite relaxed. I went inside, took the lift to the top floor, and talked to May, one of the tenants. Had she been suspicious at first of the new architects?
Well, we were at first, but then once we got to know them, we all got friendly and it started from there. And we was great, great friends after that. We've made suggestions to them and they've reversed it to us and we've come to an agreement and then they've done it.
What kind of suggestions have you made?
Well, for one thing, we wanted bigger kitchens and then we didn't want the balconies. The balconies was a sore point with some people. And then it was the windows, and we chose our own wallpapers and everything, and it went from there. And it's nice and spacious, and it's warm, and the bills are much lower than what they were over the other side.
You sound as if you're very proud of it now.
Oh, definitely.
The fascinating thing about this project is we have the same buildings, and we have the same people living here. And we now have an estate. In the new half of the estate, we have not yet had any break-ins or any vandalism. The old half of the estate is still being broken into and still being vandalised. It actually invites it. It encourages it. And what is so dramatic at Lee View is that you can see now, while parts of the old are still here for us to look at, that it is actually the design of the estate that creates social problems, physical and mental ill health, and puts enormous pressure on people so that they cannot actually behave the way they wish to behave, which is as responsible people that actually want to have a nice home and look after it.
Well, who says architecture doesn't change your life? Not, I hope, the architecture critic Colin Amory, who's in the studio now. Colin Amory, we heard there from one of the tenants of Lee View Estate, and her demands seemed so crushingly simple. A nice kitchen, a warm room to sit in, an airy living room. Why have such simple demands proved so difficult to meet?
I think it's because architects really are only just beginning to ask perfectly ordinary people what they actually want. It's hard to explain why that's happened, and they've made a great song and dance now about how much they care for the communities, having really wrecked them during the last 20 years. And they are simple things. I mean, design is not just a matter of one man putting a line on a piece of paper. It's the product of a dialogue between the client and the architect. It sounds like a cliché, but you must have that discussion.
Now, all through this programme, we've heard a series of rather harsh indictments of modern architecture. It's been called barbaric, there's been talk of murdering the city. How bad has the architecture been over the past 30 or 40 years?
Well, when you look around most of the cities of the world, they are pretty ugly as a result of the activities of architects. But it's not just architects, it's developers, it's greed, it's economists, it's politicians. And a lot of the time, it's people just really enjoying the fashion for change.
We've heard of two new schemes built or about to be completed in London, but the single most important site that Sir Hugh Casson and I looked down on from St Paul's was London's Docklands, a vast sprawling mass of redundant warehouses, factories and storage sheds, arranged higgledy-piggledy along the banks of the Thames, an area of around 8 square miles, larger than central London itself, which is currently being developed at a furious pace. Now, obviously, the new Dockland architecture is going to have an enormous influence on the appearance of London, and particularly a new scheme for the prime stretch of Dockland known as Canary Wharf, as we hear from Eddie Oliver of the London Dockland Development Corporation.
It's quite a high-rise scheme, an average of at least 8 storeys, and within the development it does include 3 skyscrapers, which would be the highest buildings in Europe. We want the best that modern architecture can provide. One of the great debates has been uniformity versus diversity. We've gone wholeheartedly for diversity. We've tried to unleash architectural spirit, and that's brought a variety of styles. Some people would find the lack of uniformity distressing. We find it exciting and vibrant.
Eddie Oliver and the unleashing of architectural spirit in London's Docklands. Colin Amory, are you optimistic about the Docklands developments?
I'm getting a bit more optimistic. I think Canary Wharf, for example, is a very good idea. It's the first scheme for Dockland, which is on a decent scale. Imagine how those docks used to be, great giant Victorian warehouses and marvellous stretches of water. And that's really been ignored until now. Docklands needs big developments, big investment, and proper links to the centre of London. You're talking about somewhere, what, bigger than Venice? And it could be just as beautiful. But it's only just beginning to hit the imagination of the planners now.
Do you think that this idea of size, of bigness, is important to the beauty of modern architecture? What is it that does make modern architecture beautiful, or how can it be beautiful?
It's not just size, it's a more subtle thing, isn't it? It's really scale and proportion and space and light. Modern architecture's great virtues really are space, light, the excitement of technology and engineering. Those are things which have developed. But people have got very tired of abstraction, no colour, lack of decoration, and use of very unsuitable materials, like in London, too much concrete in the rain looks hideous.
Is it possible, do you think, to have great architecture in this day and age when there are so many limitations on the architect, where so many people seem to be clamouring for architecture of a very specific kind? It must be very hard to build great buildings today.
No, I don't agree at all. I think it's getting much easier. The public climate is much more sympathetic. People are more informed than they used to be. In almost all cities of the world, protest about the badness of modern architecture has created a much better climate for creative thinking architecturally. I think you must remember that architecture is about art and imagination, and as well as everyday life. And now the two things are coming together. I think in the next 20 years you're going to see some very great new buildings.
Don't you think that the conservationists have grown too powerful? Now, they're always saying leave things as they are. Shouldn't we be assuming that architects have learnt from the past and encouraging them to build anew?
Well, conservation was a necessary thing because far too many beautiful things were being destroyed. They happened to be old and beautiful things, but they were being destroyed. They were a necessary break on that. But I think conservation is changing now. It's got to look more creatively at the whole problem of the whole city, not just individual monuments.
How will that new city, which you seem so optimistic about, how will that new city look?
I think if it goes the way I'd like to think it will be full of decoration and colour. That's a new side to architecture. It will have references to the past, and it will be human in scale.
And do you think, therefore, that we'll be able to look at the next 20 or 30 years and look at it with the kind of pride that equals the kind of dismay that we've looked back on the previous 30 or 40?
I'm very optimistic, particularly looking at the work of younger architects. I think we've got to forget the generation that produced the modern movement. I'm afraid they are now pieces of history. We must look to the future, and the young architects are producing very lively work.
Thank you, an optimistic Colin Amery. We leave you with closing thoughts, first from Sir Hugh Casson, 300 feet up above London, and then from Richard Rogers, dodging the workers in his glittering steel tower in the city.
I rather welcome the idea that you should keep what's worth keeping, but I think it has run the risk of becoming paralysis, because conservation is different from embalmment. There are two separate things. And I hope we're not going to become the prisoners of a Merry England pageantry come Maypole come Beefeater, and having nothing to show except what's in the past. I think that's indefensible.
There was a period, 5-10 years ago, where I feel that everybody lost their confidence. Now I think confidence is coming back again. People are beginning to say, actually, there are some good buildings of the past which we can learn from, both the near past and the distant past. And therefore, we can make statements about the pride of living in a city.